To Robin, the tiny town of Tete marked her real arrival in Africa, and her return to the world for which she had trained so assiduously and yearned so deeply. She was secretly glad that Zuger had used the unloading of the barges as an excuse not to accompany her. "You find the place, Sissy, and we'll go there together tomorrow." She had changed back into skirts. For small and isolated as it was, Tete was still a backwater of civilized behaviour, and there was no point in giving offence to the local inhabitants. Though she found the heavy folds about her legs annoying, she soon forgot them as she walked the single dusty street of the village where her father and mother must have walked together for the last time, and peered at the mud-walled trading stores built haphazardly along a rough line with the bank of the river. She stopped at one of these little dukkas and found that the storekeeper could understand a mixture of her basic Swahili, English and Nguni language, enough anyway to direct her to where the village street petered out in a mere footpath that meandered off into the acacia forest. The forest was hushed in the heat of the noon. Even the birds were silent, and the mood weighed on Robin, depressing her and awakening the memories of long-ago mourning. She saw a flash of white amongst the trees ahead and stopped, reluctant to go on to what she knew she would find. For a moment she was transported to girlhood again, to a grey November day standing beside her Uncle William, waving upwards at the passenger decks of her departing ship, her eyes so dimmed with tears that she could not make out at the crowded rail the beloved face for which she searched, while the distance between ship and quay opened like the gulf between life and death. Robin shook the memory away and went on. There were six graves amongst the trees. She had not expected that. But then she recalled that there had been heavy mortality amongst the members of her father's Kabora Bassa expedition, four of disease, one drowned, and a suicide. The grave for which she searched stood a little apart from the others. It was demarcated by a square of whitewashed river stones, and at the head was a cross built of mortar. It also had been whitewashed. Unlike the other graves, it had been kept cleaned of grass and weed, and the cross and stones freshly painted. There was even a small bunch of wilted wildflowers standing in a cheap blue china vase. They were not much more than a few days old. That surprised Robin. Standing at the foot of the grave, she read the still fully legible lettering on the plaster cross. "In loving memory of Helen, beloved wife of Fuller Morris Ballantyne, born August the 4th, 1814, died of fever December the 16th, 1852. God's will be done." Robin closed her eyes and waited for the tears to come up from deep inside. But there were no tears. They had been shed long ago. Instead, there were only the memories. Little fragments of memory played over and over in her mind. The smell of strawberries as they gathered them together in Uncle William's garden, standing on tiptoe to place one of the lush red fruits between her mother's white teeth, and then eating the half that was left especially for her. Lying cuddled under her bedclothes as she listened drowsily to her mother's voice reading aloud to her in the candlelight. The lessons at the kitchen table in winter, under the elm trees in summer, and her own eagerness to learn and to please. Her first pony ride, her mother's hands holding her in the saddle, her legs too short for the stirrups. The feel of the soapy sponge down her back as her mother stooped over the iron hip bath. The sound of her mother's laughter, and then at night the sound of her weeping beyond the thin partition beside her cot. Then the final memory of the smell of violets and lavender as she pressed her face to her mother's bodice. "Why must you go, Mama?" "Because your father needs me. Because your father has sent for me at last." And Robin's own terrible consuming jealousy at the words, mingled with the sense of impending loss. Robin knelt in the soft cushion of dust beside the grave and began to pray. And as she whispered, the memories came crowding back, happy ones and sad ones together. And she had not felt so close to her mother in all the intervening years. She did not know how long she had knelt there. It seemed an eternity. When a shadow fell across the earth in front of her, and she looked up, jerked back to the present, with a little gasp of surprise and alarm. A woman and child stood near her, a black woman, with a pleasant, even pretty face. Not young, in her middle 30s possibly, though it was always difficult to guess an African's age. She wore European-style clothing, cast-offs probably, for they were so faded that the original pattern was hardly visible, but starched and fastidiously clean. Robin sensed that they had been donned for the occasion. Although the child wore the brief leather kilt of the local Shangaan tribe, he was clearly not a full-blooded African. He could not have been more than 7 or 8 years of age, a sturdy boy with a head of dusty-coloured curls and oddly pale-coloured eyes. There was something vaguely familiar about him that made Robin stare. He carried a small bunch of the yellow acacia flowers in his hands and smiled shyly at Robin before hanging his head and shuffling his feet in the dust. The woman said something to him and tugged at his hand, and he came hesitantly to Robin and handed her the flowers. "Thank you," she said automatically, and raised the bouquet to her nose. They were faintly but sweetly perfumed. The woman hiked her skirts and squatted beside the grave, removed the wilted flowers, and then handed the little blue china vase to the boy. He scampered away towards the river bank. While he was gone, the woman plucked out the first green sprouts of weeds from the mound of the grave and then rearranged the whitewashed stones carefully. The familiar manner in which she performed the chore left no doubt in Robin's mind that she was responsible for the upkeep of her mother's grave. Both women maintained a friendly, comfortable silence, but when their eyes met, they smiled, and Robin nodded her thanks. The child came trotting back, muddy to the knees, and slopping water from the vase, but puffed up with self-importance. He had clearly performed this task before. The woman took the vase from him and set it carefully on the grave. Then both of them looked expectantly towards Robin and watched her while she arranged the acacia flowers in the vase. "Your mother," said the woman softly, and Robin was startled to hear her speak English. "Yes," she tried to hide her surprise. "My mother." "Good lady. You knew her? Please?" After the valiant opening, the woman had very little English, and their communication was halting, until Robin, out of the habit of talking to little Juba, said something in Matabele. The woman's face lit with pleasure, and she answered swiftly in a language which was obviously one of the Nguni group, and whose inflection and vocabulary differed very little from that to which Robin was accustomed. "You are Matabele?" Robin demanded. "I am Angoni," the woman put in hastily, for there was rivalry and hostility between even the closely related tribes of the Nguni. Her tribe, the Angoni, had swept northwards from their origins in the grassy hills of Zululand and crossed the Zambezi River 30 years before, she explained in her lilting musical dialect. They had conquered the land along the northern shores of Lake Marawi. It was from here that the woman had been sold to one of the Omani slave masters and had come down the Shire River in chains. Unable to keep up with the slave caravan, reduced by starvation and the fevers and hardships of the long journey, she had been freed of her chains and left for the hyenas beside the slave road. It was here that Fuller Ballantyne had found her and taken her into his own small camp. She had responded to his rough nursing, and when she was recovered, Fuller had baptized her with the Christian name of Sarah. "So my father's detractors are mistaken," Robin laughed, and spoke in English. "He made more than one convert." Sarah did not understand, but laughed in sympathy. By now it was almost dusk, and the two women, followed by the half-naked child, left the little cemetery and started back along the footpath. With Sarah still telling how when Robin's mother, summoned at last by Fuller Ballantyne, arrived in Tet with other members of the Kabora Bassa expedition, Sarah had been presented to her by Fuller as a personal servant. By now they had stopped at a fork in the path, and after a moment of hesitation, Sarah invited Robin to her village, which was only a short way off the path. Robin glanced up at the sun and shook her head. It would be dark in an hour, and Zuga would be certain to turn out the camp to search for her if she had not returned by then. She had enjoyed the hours spent with the young woman and the bright, sweet child, and when she saw Sarah's obvious disappointment, she said quickly, "Although I must go, I will return tomorrow at the same time. I wish to hear all you can tell me of my mother and my father." Sarah sent the little boy with her as far as the buildings of the village, and after the first few yards, Robin quite naturally took the boy's hand, and he skipped along beside her, chattering gay, childish nonsense, which helped to lift her sombre mood, until Robin laughed and chattered with him. Before they reached the outskirts of Tet, Robin's fears were confirmed. They met Zuga and Sergeant Chirrut. Zuga was armed with the Sharp's rifle, and angry with relief the moment he saw her. "Damn me, sissy! But you've had us all beside ourselves. You've been missing for 5 hours." The child stared at Zuga's with wide eyes. He had never seen anything like this tall, lordly man with the imperious manner and sharp, commanding voice. He must be a great chief. And he slipped his hand out of Robin's, retreated 2 paces, then turned and darted away like a sparrow from the circling hawk. Some of Zuga's anger left him as he watched the child go, and a small smile touched his lips. "For a moment I thought you'd picked up another stray." "Zuga, I found Mama's grave." Robin hurried to him and took his arm. "It's only a mile or so." Zuga's expression changed again, and he glanced up at the sun that was already on the tops of the acacia trees and turning deep smouldering red. "We'll come back tomorrow," he said. "I don't like to leave the camp after dark. There are too many jackals lurking about. 2-legged jackals." Firmly, he led her back towards the village, continuing his explanation as they walked. "We're still having a great deal of difficulty obtaining porters, despite the fact that the governor of Inquelamane assured me that they would be readily available, and the good Lord knows there are any amount of able-bodied men hereabouts. Yet that strutting popinjay Pereira finds obstacles at every turn. The frown made him look much older than his years, as did the full beard which he had allowed to grow since disembarking from Black Joke. He says that the porters refuse to contract until they know the direction and duration of the safari." "Well, that seems logical," Robin agreed. "I know I wouldn't carry one of those huge packs unless I knew where I was going." "I don't think at all that it's the porters. There is no reason why the destination should worry them. I'm offering top wages, and not a single man has come forward." "Well, what is it, then?" "Pereira has been trying to wheedle our intentions out of me, ever since we left the coast. I think this is a form of blackmail. No porters until I tell him." "Then why don't you tell him?" Robin asked, and Zuga shrugged. "Because he's too damn insistent. It's not a casual interest, and instinct warns me not to trust him with any information which it is not essential for him to know." They walked on in silence until they reached the perimeter of the camp. Zuga had laid it out in the lines of a military base, with an outer stockade of acacia thorn branches, a Hottentot guard at the gate, and the boma for the porters separated from the stores depot by the tent lines. "Looks like home already," Robin congratulated him, and would have left him for her own tent, when Camacho Pereira hurried forward.
"Ha, Major, I wait for you with good news."
"Oh, that's a pleasant change," Zuga murmured dryly.
"I find the man who has seen your father not 8 months ago."
Robin turned back instantly, her excitement matching that of the flamboyant Portuguese, and she spoke directly to him for the first time since the incident in her tent.
"Where is he?
Oh, this is wonderful news."
"If it's true," qualified Zuga with considerably less enthusiasm. "I bring the man damned quick, you see,"
Camacho promised, and hurried away towards the porter's boma, shouting as he went. Within 10 minutes he returned, dragging with him a skinny old man dressed in greasy tatters of animal skins, and with his eyes rolling up in his head with terror. As soon as Camacho released him, the old man prostrated himself before Zuga, who sat in one of the canvas camp chairs under the awning of the dining tent, and gabbled replies to the queries that Camacho shouted at him in hectoring tones.